Six Music.
BBC Radio. Six Music Documentaries.
This is BBC Radio Six Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with Tracy Thorne.
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time here on BBC Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. Today I'm welcoming someone who can be described as a friend of Six Music, first as she's a musician with eclectic tastes, but her output includes songs and performances and collaborations that make up the very fabric of our radio station, whether that's with the Marine Girls, Everything But The Girl, Massive Attack or Solo. She's also got one of those voices. My guest on The First Time this week is Tracy Thorne.
A train that wouldn't stop at my station, home alone, that was my consignment. Solitary confinement.
Here we talk about the music that made an impression on Tracy when she was growing up, the Glenn Miller Orchestra and David Cassidy, and on a slightly different tack, the huge impact that punk music had on her, the Sex Pistols, and especially the Buzzcocks. We also discuss her very earliest recordings made in a shed in Hertfordshire with the brilliant Marine Girls and her first impressions of Ben Watt, with whom she went on to go and form Everything But The Girl. Tracy also chats about her love of Billie Holiday working with Massive Attack and how her life changed in the wake of the huge global success of Everything But The Girl's iconic track, Missing. But I started by asking Tracy, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time she was aware of music?
I mean, it's very hard to pinpoint one specific moment. But I'm old enough that I grew up in a house where my parents still had some 78 records. And we had a little Dansette record player. So I do remember, as a child, being allowed occasionally to put on one of these 78s onto the Dansette record player.
What sort of thing was it?
So I had to actually go and look up who it was by, because in my memory I can still hear the song. But I never knew who it was by. It was actually by the Glenn Miller Orchestra. It makes me sound like 100 years old. I'm honestly not 100 years old. But this was the 1960s. And so my parents still had things like records by the Glenn Miller Orchestra. And it was a song called Let's Have Another Cup of Coffee and Let's Have Another Piece of Pie.
So let's have another cup of coffee and let's have another piece of pie.
I think I know that tune.
You probably do. You can probably sing it.
Yeah.
So that's honestly the first song I can remember. And me and my sister used to sing along with it. I mean, I think it was one of those songs that was quite appealing to children, you know, because it's got a slight, you know, kind of nursery rhyme lyric.
So let's have another cup of coffee and let's have another piece of pie.
Was music something that was kind of revered in the house, or was it like scenery, or was it like a special thing that happened when someone put that disc on?
It wasn't revered, no. Yeah. I think it was... my dad had been a keen music lover when he was younger, and I think he was a bit of a jazz fan and, you know, liked the big bands and stuff. And he carried on buying a few records, but, you know, it was sort of something that was just there, a bit in the background, really.
Did you have a musical epiphany? Did you have your, like, your Bowie on Top of the Pops or your certain record on the radio moment when you were, like... this is speaking to me now. This is music that I am hearing in a way that maybe no one else is.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember hearing the Sex Pistols for the first time and just sort of thinking, well, that does sound different, doesn't it? You know, even I was probably only like 13 or something.
God save the Queen, the fascist regime, it made you a moron, potential hate bomb.
It was noticeable to me, the difference, and it seemed exciting, and the fact that all the grown-ups hated it was brilliant, because, you know, we'd sort of passed the moment when they were getting that upset about the music that had come before that. And I think, you know, there was maybe that feeling already that, you know, your parents actually weren't being that offended by pop music, and then along came something they were genuinely annoyed by, so that was good, that was in its favour.
And there's nothing better for a teenager than something that actually annoys their parents.
Yeah, but it seemed to annoy everyone. It seemed to annoy everyone who was, you know, a bore. All the sort of, you know, tabloid press were up in arms about it. You know, people were apparently throwing things through their TV set in offence, you know, so it was just tremendous fun.
What about the first single that you
yes.
owned? Before then, I guess.
So then we're going way back again. We're back to the first single I can remember owning is something by David Cassidy, How Can I Be Sure, I think.
Were you a big...
teen single, yeah.
Big Cassidy fan?
I was a big Cassidy fan. He's my first album as well. My first two records are David Cassidy.
Whenever I'm away from you...
which makes me sound like the president of the David Cassidy fan club.
Did you?
Well, I was just the right age and...
Did you have the posters?
Of course. Lots of pictures of him on my wall. You know, he was very beautiful, and he was a classic heartthrob for young girls when you're just starting to think about boys, but you don't like boys who look too much like boys. So he was beautiful, you know, and had lovely long hair. So, you know, just unthreatening and girlish enough to be perfect.
How can I be sure? I really, really, really want to know.
Let's jump back to punk then.
Yeah.
So, were you Were you Pistols? Were you Clash? Were you Buzzcocks?
I was Buzzcocks, definitely. Right. Once it came to actual, you know, you're going to choose the records you're buying. I mean, I had records by all of them, and, you know, I was excited by all of them, but the Buzzcocks were the ones I fell in love with.
The most awkward of all the punk bands.
Well, precisely that. They were sort of, I don't know, you know, they did have that quality about them. They never had quite the right clothes, you know, on the front cover of the first album. You know, they just looked like a group of boys who've just kind of decided to form a band rather than this kind of, you know, the Pistols and the Clash did both have this sort of heavily stylized quality about them, you know.
They were cool.
I didn't know it at the time, but in retrospect, obviously there were other people, you know, designing those clothes for them and kind of styling them. There is an element of kind of created, manufactured pop group about them.
Which is fine.
Which is fine and absolutely fine. But the Buzzcocks were one of the first bands I ever saw who I thought had that quality of just normal people, but who had, you know, this absolutely, in Pete Shelley, this incredible skill at writing perfect pop songs and then playing them fast enough that they sounded like punk songs.
What about the first gig that really made an impression on you?
Well, the first gig I went to was XTC.
Oh, cool.
At St Albans City Hall.
What do you remember from St Albans City Hall?
I mean, I remember vividly that, and this was true from so many of the gigs I then went to, was that as much as it was about the gig, it was about the dressing up and going. And I went in a gang and we wore our customised blazers and covered in badges and you know, a massive baggy shirt and, you know, black eye makeup sort of up to here. And it was just such a scream, just being out dressed like that. And there was a band on stage. They were playing, it was their first album, I think. So it was things like Statue of Liberty and Radios in Motion and tracks like that. I remember thinking it was really exciting. Again, they were one of those bands who played everything very fast and it had that sort of hyper speedy quality.
And then stopped playing live as well. That was stage fright, wasn't
that's
it?
That's true. Yeah, so, yeah, a little identification there with him.
The first time I saw you standing in the water, you must have been all out a thousand feet tall. Oh, nearly naked, unashamed, I hair out stood. Your love was so big, it made New York look slow. Oh, you've been the subject of so many dreams since I climbed.
I'd like to talk about the Marine Girls.
Yeah.
I've got quite obsessed with Tonight, that song. You know, there's kind of, when you sort of listen to stuff by an artist you maybe haven't heard a lot of, and then a song just kind of hooks you.
Mm.
And that's been with me for weeks now. I can't shake it off. It's just brilliant.
So that's on, is that on Beach Party? Or
yeah.
Is that, yeah, that's the first. So that was one of our earliest songs. So before Beach Party even, we'd made a cassette called A Day by the Sea. So that was our, I mean, you know, you say first album. It's not an album, obviously. It was our first cassette. And I think we made 50 copies and sold them to our friends. And then had to make more because I think Rough Trade took a few copies and started selling it. So, you know, gradually a few copies of it got out there. And then we re-recorded some of those songs and added some more. And that became the first album, Beach Party.
Yeah.
So Tonight, that version is probably a slightly re-recorded version. But, you know, in songs like that, you can tell what we were listening to, can't you? You can tell we liked the Delta 5 and the Au Pairs and that whole sort of slightly choppy, trying to be a little bit funky, but without a drummer. Not sure how we thought that was going to work, but we did our best.
Some girls are really obvious and with a sidelong glance, you see them smile at every word you say.
Some girls
like to play cool, you can stare and stare, but they give nothing away.
Some boys
think they're really it, don't want to talk to you, cause all they want to do is impress.
Some boys
use the same old lines and say you want to dance and say what's your name, or let me guess, hold me tight, what we doing tonight. People make you talk when all you want to do is run away.
Sometimes
I feel I'm out of touch, no one talks to me, no one wants to hear what I say.
Sometimes
we always seem to laugh, it proves that we're alright, it proves that we can really have fun.
Sometimes
we don't even talk, and it seems to me we're not happy, but at least we're young.
Don't wanna fight, but what we're doing tonight.
What was it like being in the studio very early on then? Did you, was it?
We weren't ever in a studio.
Never. It was always just
studio. We were in a shed. I mean, Pat Birmingham, who was the guy who recorded us, he had a little mobile set up. So actually the first thing we ever recorded, he got a few local bands together in, I can't even remember what it was, like some youth club hall or something, and set up his little mobile recording studio and recorded us all. And out of those few, I think he then chose a couple to record a few more songs with, and so he chose the Marine Girls. And then we went round to his garden shed and recorded songs there. So it was ages before I saw the inside of a actual recording studio.
So what was your first impression of Ben?
It was a mixed experience, really, because I'd seen and heard of him before I met him. You know, we had that weird thing where we were both signed to Cherry Red Records. Mm-hmm. And then both happened to go to the same university at the same time. So Mike Allway at Cherry Red had been saying to me for weeks, you know, there's this other guy on the label, Ben, he's going up to Hull at the same time as you. And I was like, yeah, whatever, you know, not listening to anything anyone was telling me. And he pointed at a picture of Ben on the wall one day and went, that's him, you know, look out for him, he'll be there. So I was like, okay. So in my mind, I already had the sense of, okay, that's Ben Watt, that's what he looks like, I'll be looking out for him. And then, you know, on our first night there, he paged me over the tannoy system and said, if Tracy the Marine Girls is in the building, will she come to reception? And I assumed, oh, this must be Ben. So as I went up, I was kind of thinking, OK, I'm looking out for this guy. I know what he looks like. So it's funny because I don't have a sort of first impression of thinking, right, I've never seen this person before. But I mean, within like half an hour, I remember thinking, oh, God, it feels like I've known this person for ages. We got on really well, really quickly.
Straight away.
But then we did have a lot in common. You know, we're first day at university. So you're in that slightly freaked out kind of, am I going to make any friends here? Is anyone going to understand me? And, you know, in my first evening, I meet someone who's on the same record label as me, is making music. We've got a lot of records in common. So, you know, it felt like a very quick bond.
Because with everything with the girl, it's interesting. Most bands, kind of their early work is very obviously the sum of their influences. With everything with the girl, you were always quite, it always sounded like you. Even very, very early on, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, by the time, I don't want to talk about it, by the time the sort of you start making an impact on the charts, your voice has become this sort of beautifully, this perfect instrument within the songs. Mm. And did you spend a lot of time, you know, trying to find your voice?
Yeah, and, you know, it was, a part of it is just practice. It's just doing it over and over again. When I listen to the very early records now, they sound so obviously to me like someone who's in front of a microphone for the first time.
Really?
You know, the first Marine Girls records, my solo album, A Distant Shore, is very clearly the sound of someone who's got the microphone to herself for the first time. And I sound like I'm really enjoying it, you know, and whacking up the reverb every now and then to get this lovely sort of big, beautiful sound. But it's very much first attempts at, you know, a style and at working out how to use a microphone, how to sing in tune. You know, my pitch wanders about on that record. There's no auto tune in those days, so you just have to kind of put up with it. But then, you know, by the time you get to I Don't Want to Talk About It, I've made about 3 albums and done lots of touring as well. So I've had the experience of having to learn, you know, how to pace yourself, how to project a bit, all those things. It just comes with practice. It's a very physical act, singing. Yeah. And you don't necessarily have to learn from a teacher, but you train by doing it. You know, you become technically better at it. Like you'd become fitter if you were an athlete. You know, you just get better.
Yeah. How much did you enjoy the attention that had started to come along by that point?
I think at the beginning I enjoyed it because, you know, it's always gratifying to think that you've made something that people are interested in.
Mm.
And we slightly took it for granted, the way you do when you're young. You think you're brilliant, and so obviously people are interested. And Mike Allway always used to say that about those first Cherry Red records, that, you know, you'd put a record out, you'd get the cover of NME, you'd get Single of the Week. Of course you did. John Peel session, blah, blah, blah. You know, we just took it for granted. It's a slightly, you know, lazy assumption that you tend to make when you're young. But that's good. That sort of confidence is what gets you through.
But then you get that point where, you know, there are expectations.
Yeah.
And then that little world that you can create for yourself, it's impossible to be isolated from that bubble. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, when is this next album coming out? When are you going to do this? And you have to speak to all these people over the next 6 months and answer the same questions. You know, and some people find it quite easy to kind of, I don't know, deal with that and put a barrier up and just shake and fake. And other people find it very, very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I found some of it difficult, definitely. We were useless at interviews at the beginning, really useless. I mean, quite defensive and, you know, looking for the trick question, you know, waiting for someone to be critical. And, you know, then we'd sort of leap to our own defence, you know, before they'd even been critical. That's just lack of experience, I think. And also the times, you know, the music press was more antagonistic than it is now. And the experience of being interviewed was much more antagonistic. I'm astonished now by how nice everyone is in the music business and how nice reviewers are. You know, I read reviews and people are mostly nice about other people. Whereas I come from an era when a good old thorough slagging was what you expected, at least some of the time. So it toughened you up, I think.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
And now I'd like to sing a tune. It was written especially for me. It's titled Strange Fruit. I do hope you like it.
Oh,
bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Of the gallant south, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rise, for the tree to drop.
Here Billie Holiday.
Yeah.
When was the first, can you remember the first time you fell in love with her music?
I remember buying a Billie Holiday album, again, while I was still at school, probably I was about 17 or 18. I think I'd read about her rather than actually heard her. And, you know, I heard sort of people describe her and talk about her life story. And it just kind of resonated with me. And I went and bought an album, which must have just been a collection of tracks. You know, it wasn't a sort of famous album. And I remember just being amazed by her voice, just thinking, A, well, that doesn't sound like anyone else, does it? You know, even now, this record had been made, you know, 30, 40 years earlier, and it didn't sound like anyone else. And it, you know, it there was something really edgy and quite confrontational about it, you know, and given that I'd been mostly listening to sort of punk records and post-punk records, it seemed to me to fit and to find its place in there. You know, when you hear a song like Strange Fruit, you think, well, come on, I mean, no one's really written anything harder hitting than that. So, yeah, it really resonated with me. And I thought I was beginning to sing myself, and I was beginning to look for models of how I could sing, because I realised I wasn't going to be a punk singer. So I was looking around for other ways and other people who had, you know, distinctive voices, distinctive ways of using them. And she was one of the people, I think, who made me think, well, okay, you know, you don't necessarily have to make a loud noise to get people's attention or to be meaningful. You know, that was a lesson I learned from her.
This is The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and that was Strange Fruit by Billie Holiday, a favourite track of my guest on the show this week, Tracy Thorn.
Six Music. BBC Radio Six Music.
Six Music.
I step off the train, I'm walking down your street again, and past your door, but you don't live there anymore. It's years since you've been there. Now you disappeared somewhere, like out of space. You found some better place, and I miss you. Like the deserts miss the rain, and I miss you. Oh, like the deserts miss the rain.
Everyone, you walk behind while you
past your door. I guess you don't live there anymore.
Welcome back, I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Tracy Thorn. And that was, of course, Missing by Everything But The Girl. First released in 1994 to small but passionate acclaim, but then remixed by Todd Terry in 1995, which helped turn it into a colossal worldwide hit single. Really lovely if an artist has one of, you know, even one of those records that extends out, and it doesn't matter. It kind of, it exists so outside of everything that it came from. And
yeah.
Everybody knows it, and everyone has a place in the heart for it. People know the song without even knowing who you are and knowing the story behind it. How immediately did you realise that was going to be the case with that track and that remix?
Immediately at all. I mean, it's one of the slowest burn hits ever, I think.
But in terms of you thinking, this is going to get there?
I would say that process of thinking this might be something and to it actually happening was months long. I mean, honestly, because when the remix first came in, everyone's response was, that's great, that's just what we wanted, a remix for the US clubs. So it went out there and started doing its thing. This is already a few months after, you know, the track had originally been out and sort of apparently died. And we'd moved on and we're starting to think about our next album. Then the Todd Terry mix went out to US clubs. Then actually Ben and I went to New York for a month or so just to start doing some writing. And while we were there, we picked up a copy of Billboard magazine and saw it in the US dance chart. And no one had told us.
Really?
I remember seeing it there and going, oh, that's good. Oh, it really is doing well at US clubs. That's good. And then someone else got in touch with us and said, oh, God, it's all over the dance clubs in Italy as well. And so then it's, even from that point, you know, a few weeks passed and people began to notice. And from being in the dance charts, it was going up and up and up till it was number one in the dance charts, you know, at which point, you know, the record company started sitting around and thinking, well, hang on, maybe this could actually translate into being an actual hit. But, you know, that all this is taking weeks and weeks and weeks to happen. And then, you know, it got re-released in the UK as well. I've told the story before how we'd actually, in the meantime, been dropped by the record label. So, you know, we're working with a label who've actually just dropped us.
We're
promoting our biggest hit ever. So very, very weird. Very weird. So moment was long.
We don't want you anymore, but can we just ring this hit out first?
Can you imagine? Very awkward for everyone.
Record companies.
Ah, well, to be fair, you know, it was a kind of mutual parting of the ways. I think we'd all slightly exhausted our relationship with each other. So, you know, it wasn't like we were dropped and we were sitting at home crying. We were thinking, yeah, this is actually fine. This is a new beginning. Mm. And we knew, you know, that we were full of ideas. I'd done the collaboration with Massive. You know, we thought Missing was great, even if it hadn't been a hit. We just thought, well, that doesn't matter. We've still made a really great record. We knew we had. So, you know, we were feeling very positive. So then it was just, you know, then it becoming a massive hit was just the sort of proof that we weren't going mad. We didn't know we had something good here.
In terms of Massive Attacks, another of those songs that we have to talk about, the image of them in the studio is we talk about things taking a long time, is that things are slowly layered and built and taken away and various people wander in and out the studio for years until eventually a song sort of emerges like sort of smoke escaping from a room with Massive Attack. Is it like that?
I think it's more and more like that as time goes
by. These days.
When I look back to how, you know, how Protection came together, you know, it was super quick by Massive standards. They sent me a cassette of the backing track and, you know, I wrote a song idea over the top of it. They liked it immediately. I came in and recorded the vocal properly with them and they added a little bit more to it. But, you know, there's not much else on the track other than that very sparse backing track they sent me and my vocal kind of out on its own. So then it was a little bit of production magic by Nellie Hooper. But no, that track itself didn't take years and years and years to complete. So, yeah.
This girl I know needs some shelter. Your arms around her.
I mean, how, once again, you sort of imagine that all of a sudden, off the back of these songs, like the phone doesn't stop ringing. Oh, will you come and do vocals on this song? Will you come and do vocals? It's Madonna wants to meet you. Did all that kind of thing happen?
More in the wake of Missing, right, actually, and more in terms of just, oh, it, you know, if you get Tracy to sing on it, we can have a dance hit. So there was a bit of that. Just, you know, anyone who'd kind of cobbled together a house beat.
Get her in.
Probably thought for a while. So I did get lots of rubbish. Almost all of which I said no to. To be fair, I do still get sent things, you know, which sometimes I think, wow, this really is just coming from a place of, you've cobbled something together, and if we can get Tracy on it, maybe it'll be a hit. And then every now and then I get something brilliant, and I'm still happy to collaborate with people, but it does mean picking my way through it a bit.
Did you turn anyone down that, with hindsight, you were like, oh, I should have done that?
No.
That's good.
Yeah, I think, you know, if I credit myself with one quality, I do think it's that I've got quite good instincts. You know, when Massive sent me that track, and it, honestly, if you'd heard it in its initial state, you know, it was pretty rough and ready. But I just thought, yeah, that can work. And as soon as I started singing over it, I thought, yeah, that can work. And the collaborations I've done, it's all been things that when I've been sent them, I've heard something and thought, yeah, that would definitely. So no, actually, there aren't any that I think, oh, I missed that one.
Yeah. But John Grant, that's a lovely one. I mean, a beautiful guy, incredible vocalist, and a great song.
Yeah.
Tell me about recording that with him.
We did that at Long Distance. That was one of those ones where we didn't end up being in the same studio. I recorded my bit and sent it to him.
That was it?
Yeah. The general case in German, it's true, is something that I am quite partial to.
Rachmaninoff, Scriabin, Prokofiev, Dostoevsky, Bulgakov, Vysotsky, and Lev.
Francis Bacon and the Dolomites, ballet dancers with or without tights, Central Park on an autumn day will always be stunning and never cliché.
All this said, just disappointed. All these things
have just, well, yeah, we just didn't manage to actually be in the same place at the same time.
But it started a friendship.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we'd already met up, I think, before that, and then, you know, determined to work together. And then he sent me that song with its amazing lyrics, you know, gave me the chance to sing all sorts of extraordinary things.
Because you do have that thing where, like, if you are lucky enough to have a career that lasts a certain amount of time, then people start coming through who are influenced by you and start wanting to work with you. That's got to be an enormously touching thing to happen.
Yeah, that's lovely. And, you know, I tend to hear that more and more now. You know, I bump into people who are of a generation where, you know, I mean, John Grant remembers us from the 80s. You know, he remembers listening to the Love Not Money album in the mid 80s. But then I've met other people like, you know, the XX and, you know, Jenny from Savages, you know, who kind of know me from the 90s and, you know, were young when they were growing up and hearing things like Missing and hearing Protection. And, you know, so I feel like, you know, sort of godmother figure to that generation, which is a brilliant feeling, you know. It's really nice.
Your book, your first book, this is all about first. Did you enjoy, because it got incredible reviews, it's a lovely piece of work and, you know, did very well. Did you enjoy the process of trawling through your past? He asks during a programme where you're trawling through your past.
I actually did, because I started writing it in about 2005 or six, when I'd had that was my period of retirement. You know, I hadn't recorded since about 2000, and I'd been at home for 5 years with the kids, and I was very happy, but I was just coming to that point at the end of it of thinking, what am I going to do? Am I going to work again? Am I going to record again? And I slightly had to remind myself who I'd been, you know, why was I even thinking about recording? Where had it started? So I started trawling through just all my, you know, diaries and reading reviews and press cuttings. And I started writing it all down. I wasn't sure it was a book. I just thought, I'm kind of making sense of it for myself. And I wrote about 80% of Beds at Disco Queen, put it away in a box under the bed and went back into the studio and made an album instead. Because it actually reminded me, and it made me think, now, come on, you used to have all this energy about music. You know, where's that gone? Get back in there and do it. And I made the Out of the Woods album. And it wasn't until after that was done and finished, and even a little bit later than that, I think, that someone said to me one day, a literary agent said to me, have you ever thought of writing a book? And I said, well, I kind of have written a book. Here it is. And I handed it over and they just went, well, that's a book.
all those words you've written on pages.
It's more or less finished.
It's a book.
And it had been sitting there for quite a while. So I updated it a little bit. So there's a section towards the end when I actually describe the return to music. You know, I end at the point where I just come back and started recording again. So that was sort of added later. But I just remember putting it away because I thought, look, that's interesting to me, but that's because it's me talking about my life. No one else is going to be interested in all that. So I was amazed that people were as interested. But I think I realised that I'd told lots of other people's story as well as my own, you know, because I talked about that era and, you know, growing up through punk and going to gigs and then what the 80s music scene was like and what it was like to have a dance hit in the 90s. And I think for the people who read it, I was telling the story of the music eras they'd grown up through as well.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't just like, this is me, a celebrity. Let me tell you about the time I met so-and-so. It was more a kind of account of those times.
Do you find it easier to write than make music these days?
I honestly enjoy both now.
Yeah.
And I'm really grateful that I have a chance to do both. Because, you know, I can do different things in each medium now. So yeah, I absolutely don't feel now like I can come down on one side or the other and say, right, this is what I'm going to focus on now. It's the music or it's the writing. I'm really grateful to be able to go back and forth between them.
Yeah. In terms of Everything But the Girl, I mean, it's a question you get asked all the time in terms of, to apply it to a first. Was there a moment when you and Ben kind of first thought, we can just put this over here. We don't feel any need to return to it.
Well, I made the decision a bit unilaterally, really, when I decided to, you know, retire. And that was partly because I wanted to stop touring. I absolutely didn't want to do that anymore. Mm. And I just said, OK, I just want a proper break. I want to be at home with the kids. So during that period, Ben got very busy doing other things. You know, he didn't sit around at home moping. He just thought, OK, fine, right, I'll start a record label, off onto DJing. And then himself has ended up returning to making solo records. Mm. So, you know, there wasn't really one key moment, but I think it's just the way our lives have now evolved. The idea of reforming Everything But The Girl seems like a real step backwards.
Yeah.
Whereas everything else we've done in the time since Everything But The Girl feels like it's been a step forward, you know, or a step sideways over here, you know, just doing other interesting things. And, you know, I think we both just feel, look, as long as we've got the chance to do that, then that seems like the direction to keep moving in forwards. Mm. You know, it might be a zigzag line. But the pressure of the reunion and what it implies, you know, what are you doing? Are you following up the last record you made 20 years ago? You know, I just think, oh, why would you want that?
I always quite like it when bands get together with the lineup that people have, just call it something different to kind of. I think David Sylvian did it with Japan, didn't he?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, this is a different band. It's not the same band. But it kind of, it gives you the freedom to do what you want, but the joy of performing with the musicians and the friends that you've got a name for.
And it's not like Ben and I don't ever work together, you know, quietly in the background. He is sometimes playing guitar on things I've done in the past. And, you know, we do tend to make little appearances, but it's just without actually making a big thing and going, right, this is a reunion.
In terms of record, in terms of the most recent album, was there, did you have any specific ideas about what you wanted it to be like, or do you wander into the studio and let things unfold?
I mean, I knew I wanted it to be a really kind of up-tempo, assertive record. I wasn't in the mood for making particularly a distant shore type, you know, introspective, acoustic, downbeat record. Partly because I was actually feeling a bit depressed about the world in general. And I just thought, I want to make a record to cheer myself up. Maybe it will cheer other people up as well. You know, I was just at the end of all the sort of political events that culminated in, you know, Brexit, US election, everything. Ugh. And I just thought, you know, I want to write some really direct, quite assertive songs and make a really up-tempo record. And I wanted to work with Ewan Pearson on some stuff that we actually hadn't done before, because I've worked with him quite a lot. But given that he's a dance producer and a remixer and a DJ and loves New Order and the Pet Shop Boys and what have you, I felt like we hadn't completely explored that together. We've done quite a lot of acoustic recording together. So I said to him, right, come on, let's get in the studio, get your synths out, you know, let's get some beats going. And he was like, oh, hello, come on, now you're talking. So that was the spirit behind it.
Yeah, it has got this very positive disposition to it. Interesting you say that it was born out of being a bit depressed.
Yeah, well, sometimes that can be inspirational. You know, sometimes being angry and fed up about things can be inspirational. Sometimes when you're very content, ironically, you coast a little bit. Mm. But, you know, there was that slight, you know, friction involved in feeling a bit, not just depressed, but a bit angry about the world. And, you know, that's sometimes, you know, puts you into a sort of energetic frame of mind.
Yeah, because it's interesting. I mean, obviously, it's something that we talk to musicians a lot about, is about the environment in which their songs are written. Mm. And it's absolutely unavoidable that no matter what side of the fence you sit on, and anyone may sit on whichever side of the fence they wish, we're living in challenging times for many, many people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're living in quite extreme times again. And, you know, a lot of people have said, especially anyone my age, it does remind us a little bit of the 80s.
That's where I was going.
And people have often pointed out, you know, how energised the music scene was in the 80s, and particularly energised by politics and social affairs and, you know, that sense of having a social conscience, which was very much obviously part of the music scene I came out of. You know, you just thought that was inevitably part of it, that people did benefit gigs and went on marches and, you know, had something to say about the sort of events of the time.
Yeah.
And it does feel a bit like a return to that, you know. In the meantime, you know, we've been through a period when people have said, oh, it, you know, what, the end of history, you know, all politics has turned into the same. We've ended up in this kind of mushy, bland centre where everything is the same. Well, you know, it's a bit be careful what you wish for, because now we're back to a sort of more polarised time. And, you know, it's difficult, but sometimes it does produce, you know, art that comes out of that.
Yeah, I think in the, not just now, but in the years to come, as people hit, you know, that wonderful, that teen, that 14, 15, 16, when you become self-aware and you become aware of your environment and you get the confidence to be creative. I think people in that age now, I think the impact on this, on music, on all arts, but music is definitely going to be felt for a long time to come.
Yeah, let's hope.
The last thing we do is ask you to pick the last song. It can be anything you want, something of yours, something of someone else's, something you heard this morning, or a favourite track.
Oh, what, something...
Anything
that you play.
Want, that we shall close the song up. That we shall close the show.
I should choose something by me, shouldn't I? But that
you can do that.
No, I don't want to do that. That's a bit like who was it who went on Desert Island Discs and chose all tracks by themselves.
I think you're allowed to do that. Play a lot of your stuff here anyway.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Show anyway.
Okay, play 1950 by King Princess.
Why?
Because I love it, and I'm just keep listening to it at the moment. I've been listening to it for the last few weeks. It's great.
Then that's the song we should finish on. It's been lovely to speak to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hate it when dudes try to chase me, but I love it when you try to save me, because I'm just a lady. I love it when we play 1950. So cold that your stare's about to kill me. I'm surprised when you kiss me. So tell me why my guys look like you, and tell me why it's wrong. So away.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
You only write one cigarettes and alcohol in your lifetime, if you're lucky.
Straight up bangers, obscure gems and long forgotten favourites.
Every emotion has a sound to it.
You just gotta do you.
This is Alt 90s on BBC Sounds.
Don't you understand, oh my little girl?